Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with writers in the studios of North State Public Radio. Now here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
In 1955, Carl Ochsner left his one-room schoolhouse in Wisconsin and enrolled in a large suburban elementary school in East Los Angeles County. In his memoir, A New Age Diary, Personal Glimpses of Life in Postmodern America, Carl Ochsner recounts his experiences in California's counterculture. He describes what it's like to spend time in jail, what it's like to be homeless. Of course, there's much more to your book, Carl. So welcome. We want to hear about this. Welcome, Carl Ochsner.
And I'm delighted to be here. Thank you so much for reading my book and for inviting me to talk about it.
Well, you spent so much time in Southern California and on the coast of California. What brought you to Chico?
Well, it's a long story. I came to Northern California because I was a land-hungry fool in 1991, 1992. And my wife, Vicki, and I decided that we wanted to buy more property. We weren't necessarily interested in a larger house. And I had an opportunity to take a job on the Humboldt Coast. I worked over there as the executive director of a large multi-sided human service agency for 8 years. And then I was offered the opportunity to come to Chico and replace a guy that I greatly admired, a guy named Barry Dyer, who was the executive director of Work Training Center in Chico for about 20 years. So I took his position and did that for about 13 years and then retired myself and went into consulting.
Well, I want to ask you about the cover of your book, because on the front, there's this young guy sitting on the Mendocino Coast. And then we turn the book over and look at the back, and there's this older person, and there's something about this photograph on the back of your book. You're sitting with your arms on a table. And when we first see this photograph, we don't know the significance of that table. What's important about that table where you're sitting?
Well, the table kind of symbolically represents the transition from rural South Central Wisconsin, where the walnut wood was grown and
harvested. So it's a walnut, a table made of
walnut. It's a walnut table. And just before we left Wisconsin, when I was 7 years old, my father had that walnut milled into a bedroom set and a table with benches. That table was our dinner table all the years we were growing up in Southern California. And when my dad's house was sold, my sisters and I divided up some of the stuff, and I had it completely refinished. In fact, we just had breakfast on it this morning with a former exchange student and her husband.
What a nice thing to have, memories all incorporated into that walnut table. My guest is Carl Ochsner, and he's written a memoir, A New Age Diary, Personal Glimpses of Life in Postmodern America. And you mentioned that you weren't born here in California, and you would go back to Wisconsin from time to time. And I was so impressed with the responsibility that you and your brother were given when you went back to Wisconsin. You weren't treated like a kid; you were treated like an adult.
Well, the interesting thing. I'm writing this book from the point of view of a young man, a teenager at one point, and then, of course, reflecting back on it as an individual who spent several decades and achieved education and a lot of other experiences. And also, I've been involved over the years with different community committees having to do with how we socialize and raise and educate our kids. And so I'm trying to kind of lead the reader here to look at how young men are socialized. And we're having a lot of problems in the way that young men are being brought into adulthood, not just young men of minority groups, but white young men as well. And I'm kind of suggesting that perhaps the way you socialize young men is by putting them with grown, functional men. Not just in a role modeling, but in a supervisorial, kind of a guiding sort of a way. And the idea that we have created large urban high schools with 1,600 teenagers all in the same place all week long with very few adults around is probably not the way nature intended us to come into adulthood, particularly our young men. I think they benefit from having real responsibility, things that involve some significant risk.
Because it's dangerous. The equipment you and your brother are working, especially your brother, because your brother was a little older, could be dangerous. He had to really pay attention, keep his wits about him. And you say that when you would go back to Wisconsin to the farm, you said, I was given a small orange-colored Alice Chalmers tractor with a hay rake attached. And when instructed in the relatively simple and safe task of raking, cut, and dried hay into windrows. but meanwhile, your brother, who was a little older, was aware that he had been given a real job to do, including a potentially disastrous outcome if he failed by adults who had confidence that he could do it.
Oh, exactly.
You say, in the mass culture of suburban Southern California at that time, such opportunities for teenage boys to enter the world of real men were becoming increasingly rare. So you mentioned that, being socialized. These kids back in Wisconsin on the farms felt comfortable with adults.
Oh, yeah, they did. They weren't as sophisticated and as savvy about rock and roll records and what was going on in the world of celebrity, but much more comfortable interacting with adults on a day-to-day, let's-get-it-done kind of basis. And that's because that's how they were being raised. You didn't have huge groups of teenagers wandering the streets trying to figure out why they were there. You know, if you're growing up on a farm in Wisconsin, if you don't know why you're there, your dad or your grandfather will quickly show you why you're there.
Well, I was struck by the fact that you say that your father had gone to he lived in Wisconsin. In the fall of 1934 is when he graduated.
Oh, he entered high school in the fall of
34. Entered high school. And at that time, adults wore business attire and presumed a superior and authoritative role in transmitting the key aspects of the culture to the students. So here you had a distinct difference in the roles of the teachers in the school and the students. Boys wore well-trimmed hair and tucked-in collared shirts, with the girls in proper-length skirts with sleeved blouses and sweaters. And that ain't the way it was.
Well, what I'm suggesting in the passing music is that I was there on the ground as that fundamental change took place. It took about 12 years in our school in Azusa for that pattern that had been going on for decades to change. And by the end of the decade, we were in a world where it was much more likely that you were catering things to the kids, asking them what they wanted. Giving them choices, and I'm not making a heavy judgment on that, but I'm saying that now what I see in my kids and their kids and in the way we raise children, it's almost automatic to ask children what they want. My grandfather, a great-grandfather, simply wouldn't have occurred to him that you ask kids what they want.
Well, you do say that just in the time that from your older brother graduating to your younger brother graduating high school 12 years later, all that had changed. And you did mention the way adults, it wouldn't occur to them to ask you what you wanted, Carl.
Right. Yeah.
And my mother would often repeat, children should be seen and not heard.
Right.
So you were not asked your opinion, you behaved yourself, and you knew your role as a child in the family.
Well, you know, families were larger too, Nancy. So, for instance, we had 7 kids in our family. And so you never got the feeling that you were the center of the family. You were sort of along for the ride. The grown-ups were the important ones. And I'll see parents going down the shopping lane with their kids, and they'll say, do you want cornflakes or do you want, what do you want? And I'm not saying that that's bad. I'm just saying that that's a fundamental change, and it's had lots of other implications as well.
After a break, Carl Ochsner and I will continue our conversation about his experiences as part of the California counterculture. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. Thank you. I'm Nancy Wiegman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My guest is literary advocate and author Carl Ochsner. And there are things in your memoir, Carl, experiences that you had are so alien to anything in my own experience, for example. And I even had the image of here you are coming down as an alien, and I'm getting a chance. Wow, that's what it was like when he was growing up. Because the things you were just saying, I experienced too. Mm-hmm. I experienced this change. But you described time you spent in jail. Oh, my goodness, Carl. Knowing you now, who would ever suspect that right. you spent time
and
in
Nancy,
jail?
And, Nancy, there was a reason why I had to wait until I was done with legitimate employment and because I didn't want to embarrass any of the businesses or organizations that I was involved in and bring up things that obviously in politics, you know, if you've got things you said 40 or 50 years ago, boy, somebody got them on tape and you're done. but yeah, I was just like a lot of young men. I had a real easygoing parenting style in my parents. Hey, find your own way, Carl. And I found my way into a lot of trouble, not mean and evil things, but just stuff where you'd end up having the contents of your pockets on the hood of a police car at 9 o'clock on a weeknight because you were out wandering around where you shouldn't be. And then it turned out that you had a warrant out because of an unpaid traffic ticket or something you didn't take care of earlier. And I think finally the authorities just got disgusted and said, hey, you're going to go to L.A. County Jail. Let's see if a few days in jail gets your head right. And so that's how I ended up getting into that culture and having to quickly figure out how to navigate it because jail, there's some very dangerous people in jail.
Well, and you were saying that you hadn't really done anything that was a threat to anybody, but you say you did spend more than just once in jail.
Yeah.
You said you spent a few short stints in jail. And you said, for example, I think it was about 14 or so nights that I spent in the L.A. County Jail at age 19.
Yeah.
Plus another 10 days, 2 years later in Sonoma County, not to mention a few one-nighters here and there. I've often tried to see how these experiences might have benefited me in the long run.
I think I'm one of those people, and bless those who are not, but I was one of those individuals who had to learn everything experientially, or as the old-timers would say, the hard way. So yeah. What happens if I decide to try to get some marijuana from here to there at 5 in the afternoon in a car with broken taillights? Well, what happens is inevitable. And so those kinds of things, just stumbling from one cow pie into another, basically. And so what I'm trying to do here is say, look, here's what it was like. Here's how I was able to survive. And one of the tools that I found in my tool bag, because despite all of the goofing around that I did, in irresponsible, ungoal-oriented behavior, I was always an excellent reader. I learned to read well enough in a one-room schoolhouse in Wisconsin that by the time I got to Southern California, I was given the job of sitting outside and listening to the other kids read because I was already at second or third grade level, a couple of grade levels ahead.
And do you know, when I read your book, I was surprised. It never would have occurred to me that this could be a skill that would be protective, because I think of it, if you'd been a big, hulking, 300-pound, 6'5 guy, then okay, they're not going to mess with him. But if you're just a normal person, you got to watch yourself, because you mentioned that there are guys in that jail who are serious offenders.
Oh yeah, and they're not pleasant. They're not nice. There's a good group in there that are just guys like me that were in the wrong place at the wrong time. But I found that my literacy was an asset, because as soon as people got the idea that, well, he might be able to read this letter that I got from the court or that I got from my attorney, and that I could read it and say, yeah, well, here's what they're trying to tell you. This is what this means. You got to do this. And of course, I wasn't an attorney, but I just had already read many dozens of novels, and I was at a sophisticated enough level that I knew what some of these words meant that some of the other folks in jail were having problems with.
For example, you say that there's a huge difference, for example, between the words should and shall when they appear in a piece of writing that deals with legal matters. And so at 19, you knew those differences, and you could help out your fellow prisoners Jaylee's.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, is advice. Maybe you ought to do this, maybe you ought to do that. When it, shall means, no, you did get this done by such and such a date.
So you then take a little aside in your recounting of your experiences and address youthful readers of your memoir. And what do you tell these young people who might read your book?
Well, just whatever you do, even if you stumble through your late teens and early 20s the way I did, learning to read and learning to read well is the most liberating thing you can do. And it gives you an asset, a saleable asset that no one will ever be able to take away from you. And so that's one of the reasons, even now as I've crossed my 70th birthday a couple of years ago, I'm heavily involved in efforts to help young readers in Chico. I volunteer as a reading pal at McManus School. I'm part of a service club that has made it its business to provide reading materials and fix up libraries in all of the elementary schools around Chico.
My guest is Carl Ochsner, and we're talking about his memoir, A New Age Diary, and the fact that Carl spent time in jail. And he has advice for younger people to hone your literacy skills. But you said, even for me, having a valuable skill was not enough. I realized, too, I had to adopt a set of behaviors that collectively I now refer to as body armor.
Yes, and I use that term because you don't see the body armor, but there's a certain posture that you have to have, a certain use of language. You don't want to make yourself stick out, and you want to look as powerful and even as dangerous as you can, or at least raise the question in other people. Wow, is this guy going to be okay to pick on, or is he somebody that's going to come back at me? So you slow down your speech. You get rid of all the educated usage in it.
Or pretentious words.
You adopt a certain sort of language in a way that you hold your head and your chest so that you're looking as powerful as you can, kind of a don't-give-a-damn swagger. And, of course, the black guys in jail were really good at that. The rest of us tried to model it.
A couple of things you were saying that, one, you watch your speech, you slow it down, and use probably language you wouldn't normally use, your parents would not
use it.
Yes, and
then we're not going to use it on the radio station here, but you'd use a lot of adjectives over and over again.
And the second thing you mentioned was the way you move your body, the way you walk down the mezzanine from cell to shower room, and there was a stance and a swagger that, as you said, lets people know, don't mess with me. And you said you didn't want to look like a punk or a chump, a potential victim. So the bottom half of your body moved with a smooth, graceful confidence, and meanwhile, your torso and shoulders expressed power, chest out, head up and back, just a bit, shoulders and arms controlled in a forward sway. So you and your cellmates would say, okay, there's what I need to do. I need to walk like guy does.
Yeah, exactly. And you make yourself large, same way as if you're confronting a mountain lion. You give yourself a lot of presence, and yet you don't want your language or anything to make you appear to be someone who grew up on the prissy side of town. you want to look tough. And there's a lot of humor in what goes on in there, and the clothing that we were given to wear. As I say, they took your belt away, and all the clothing was oversized. So on the littler guys, it was kind of funny because they'd have to button every button to make sure their shirt stayed on, and then kind of hold up their pants with one hand as they're walking around. And I don't know the answer to this, but it's, to me, very intriguing that style made it out of jail and now kind of runs the show fashion-wise for several decades afterwards, not just in black inner-city areas and Mexican-American areas, but in white suburbia.
You did mention, you said, that Mexican-Americans helped spread this jailhouse style of men's clothing. And I thought it was just from the black community, African-American community, that this style of clothing. But you say that that was also the Mexican-Americans.
Well, yeah, and that's where my experience was more. I grew up in the East San Gabriel Valley, learned to speak Spanish, went to school in a real integrated settings, had groups of friends that were a lot of Mexican-Americans, what we call Mexican-American in those days, you'd call your Latino buddies nowadays.
Yeah, you're saying this terminology wasn't in vogue when you were.
No.
So you refer to them as Mexican Americans, whereas today we might call them Chicano or
Hispanic. But in those days, Hispanic, you thought about, you know, famous people that you saw on TV, like Dolores
Ricardo
Del
Montalban.
Rio, Ricardo Montalban. Yeah, those kind of people.
Well, you learn how to cope in jail. And then there were also your sense of acute observation stood you in good stead when the subject of hitchhiking came up, whether you were going to pick somebody up or you were being picked up as a hitchhiker. And you say you spent between 1965 and 73, you did an enormous amount of hitchhiking, covering most of the western USA, but most particularly in California, from the Mexican border to Santa Rosa.
And I actually, the longest hitchhiking trip I took was from Great Falls, Montana to Las Vegas. That was the longest single stretch. But I was in western Canada. But as I say, mostly in California. And whether you're picking up hitchhikers or whether you're the hitchhiker, you've got to use profiling. And the reason I brought that up is because there's been so much discussion over the last 20 or 30 years about profiling. And I think I'm suggesting that naturally we all do it. Now, oftentimes it's justified or it's the only evidence you have. There are other times when, as I point out in my recent experiences in Fresno, when you're just completely off the money. But when somebody is slowing down to take a look at you, what they're looking for are signs of, is this person safe to pick up? So for example, irrespective of race or color, if there was a guy with his girlfriend, and realize back in those days, the on-ramps were covered with hitchhikers. There'd be 12, 15. In Santa Barbara, the street would be lined with hitchhikers. So if you saw a guy with his girlfriend and they had a sign that said San Francisco and they each had a backpack, to me, that was a pretty safe bet. On the other hand, one time my friend and I got in a car. We were the hitchhikers. We got picked up by two guys. It was the middle of winter. They were trying to get out of California as quickly as possible. They had no jackets, and they weren't quite sure how to operate the automobile. And we realized after they finally let us out, those guys stole that car, and they're trying to get out of the state, you know, would be the only hypothesis that would fit those pieces. And so, it's probably good advice to not hitchhike. But realize that 19, 20-year-old, 21-year-old young guys, a lot of times you're looking for adventure. You're looking for a little bit of adrenaline. And, you might get into something that's a little difficult. And then getting yourself out makes you feel empowered and successful.
My guest is Carl Ochsner, and he's written a memoir, A New Age Diary. And at this point, we're learning what he learned. If you are hitchhiking or if you're picking up hitchhikers, and you mentioned a guy with his girlfriend and they have backpacks, pretty safe bet. But you say clothing inappropriate for the weather, like you just mentioned, two white guys with short hair, no backpacks and any tattoos were not riding with me, and I never picked up or accepted rides from three males together, no matter what.
Yeah, it was just the idea that you'd be able to get yourself out of that car and out of trouble if you needed to. The odds were too stiff when you had. So I was always looking for the same thing. If somebody stopped to pick me up and they had the right look and they had a girlfriend with them or something, then I'd get in the car. But yeah, three guys. And in those days, tattoos were heavily identified with people who had previously been in prison or in the military. If you saw a tattoo, especially on somebody's neck or face, that was a no-fly.
Well, you describe your upbringing, and there's a section in your book when you talk about your dad, and it's complimentary, I find, that when you're discussing growing up, and we talk about the fact this walnut table that he had made is still a part of your family. But you say that your dad possessed a great number of very positive attributes and was an intelligent, amiable, and well-read man. For these reasons, and certainly because of the hospitality offered in our kitchen, my father was known to all our friends as the coolest dad around. However, the pattern set for my brothers and for me would contain complications that none of us at the walnut table in the late 60s could foresee.
Yes, the I'm suspecting that in our families, particularly running through my mom's side, that we have the genetic predisposition to addiction to substances. And so my dad, with all the best intentions in the world, and again, I bring this up because you hear people talking about harm reduction a lot. There's a controversy in Chico right now about should we allow harm reduction to drive social policy.
And what do you mean by harm reduction?
Harm reduction is the idea that you don't try to prohibit pleasurable things, prostitution, drugs, alcohol, and so forth, but rather you try to establish ways that you reduce the peripheral harm that's
caused. So if you're sitting around sitting around with your parents and your dad has a beer, he won't say, "Well, son, you're too young to have a beer." He would say, "Yeah, here, go ahead and try it, because that way you won't go out and do it when you're not supposed to."
Yeah, yeah. And my dad thought that he kind of believed in the often discussed European model that you socialize kids with alcohol at the kitchen table. And what he didn't realize is that he himself was not a moderate drinker. And secondly, that we weren't just drinking beer with my dad. We were drinking beer and using other substances lots of other places as well.
Besides, it was an and.
Exactly. And I didn't bring this all up in the book because I wanted to keep the focus pretty tight. But I've lost three of my brothers now to premature death, two of them to drug and alcohol overdoses. My older brother died of lung cancer, but he was a two-pack-a-day, several 12-pack-a-week drinker. And they were all intelligent guys. My older brother was a mechanical engineer. So, you know, that's what I'm alluding to there, is that my dad didn't see that by giving us a green light and saying, you know, use of things that alter your brain chemistry, which is ethyl alcohol, basically, and other substances, that, you know, that's going to set a pattern. And you might have a hard time later on saying goodbye to these things when it's time to do that.
Well, you mentioned what happened to your brothers, for example. One thing I appreciated, Carl, is in the back of your book, you give us kind of an update of these friends and people in your book whose names you've changed.
Correct.
And I was shocked at how many of them didn't make it out of their 40s.
That's I don't know. I'm writing this book to say, hey, researchers out there, sociologists, cultural anthropologists, whatever, see if these anecdotes prompt something that should be looked at. But in our working class neighborhood in industrial East Los Angeles County, the attrition was horrible, particularly in my youngest brother's friends. Out of that group of 8 or 10 friends, 8 are now dead. From just the lifestyle choices. And I one of them was the model for, Santo.
Mm-hmm.
Santo, who there were a group of young men a couple of years younger than me that lived in the east side of Azusa, and pretty much they all perished. And the last couple decades, they were just living on alcohol, methamphetamine, whatever they could get their hands on.
And this all is a part of the surfing life that you have a chapter on.
Well, you know, Nancy, some of the things that I put into this book, I didn't want it to just be one dreary thing after another. And I thought, you know, here's an opportunity to take a little side trip here or there, which I did with about the band and the surfing lifestyle, because I was right there. And there are some myths, and one of the things I saw a lot is I'll see these perfectly restored Woodies with surfboards always on the roof.
And you've got a photograph of a Woody, a 1940s Woody wagon on the beach in the 1960s. Now, this didn't happen to have the roof rack that you just mentioned.
No, and it wouldn't, because you didn't put roof racks. The reason you got a van or a Woody or, an old beat-up panel truck is so you could throw the surfboards in the back and not worry about tying them on the top. And so that's kind of how things sort of change over the years until something becomes kind of legendary. But it was a magical time. I mean, we had access to the entire Southern California coastline in an era when you could still find places where if you played it cool, you could park for the night, get up in the morning, go surfing, and then come back home and go to your evening job or whatever. And that was it was a very adventurous and fun time. But as it morphed over the years and things got added to it, I kind of carry it into what I saw as some young people who were emerging into a different kind of a lifestyle.
Well, even those of us on the other side of the States were listening to beach music and the Beach Boys and all this that you were living. You were right when in the middle of everything that was changing so rapidly in our country.
Yeah, and I think the West Coast, probably starting way back in the 1920s, California was driving the cutting edge. That's where you went if you wanted to be free of all of these inhibitions and things that your little town in Ohio or whatever was doing to you. So, it was a great time to be there, actually.
Well, I mentioned the Beach Boys, and you, as a child of your era, also had a band.
we did. Garage bands are still very, very popular. Actually, my granddaughter who plays bass for a recently broken up group called OJ and the Pulps, but now she's getting involved with another one. So, and that was I'm trying also there to show how melding of cultural traditions and just being together with people from different backgrounds facilitates cooperation, good times, getting familiar with one another.
After a break, I'll be continuing my conversation with Carl Ochsner, whose memoir is A New Age Diary. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with author Carl Ochsner, a Wisconsin native who grew up in Southern California. And he has had such a wide variety of experiences, some of them typical of others in his age group at the time. For example, having a band. And what kind of music did you play?
Well, we tried to, in a kind of a comical way, we tried to copy what were popular English groups at the time. The Rolling Stones was our idol. They had just been around for a couple of years then, but also the Animals and some others. The Beatles music was very difficult to play. But then we had a south of the border Hispanic influence because there were certain songs that were popular at high school dances and so forth. And the two members of our band that were from the barrio, Santo and Tommy, they wanted to introduce those. So we had a kind of a competition and inside the band and a combination of things. And then, of course, the real irony of it is a lot of the songs that we were trying to play from the English groups had actually been appropriated from black American Mississippi Delta blues and Chicago blues and so forth. So I put a little chart in there that kind of traces where those songs originated and how we ended up with them.
This back and forth that the Brits listened to our rock and roll and blues and jazz, and then we are listening to the Brits saying, oh, that sounds good.
Right.
And
so I think
it comes back.
There were a whole generation of us that were introduced to songs by Chuck Berry, Willie Dixon, and other black artists for the first time that it actually those songs had been released back in the 50s. Well, the kids in Liverpool, England were listening to them, and in London were listening to them, and they sort of reintroduced them to us, and then we tried to copy their versions.
Well, if you have this lifestyle where you have a band and you are a surfer, there's something else that goes along with that lifestyle, and you have a chapter, the Zacatecas Reefer, and in that chapter, you describe your experiences with marijuana.
Yes, it's that was one of the first chapters that I wrote because I didn't have in mind that I was going to publish this book. I was just writing pieces here and there. And that started because of a group of people who I was involved with a few years ago regarding how do we deal with youthful drug use? How do we deal with keeping drugs out of the hands of kids before they become adults and so forth? And so I thought, well, I'll just tell what my story was. And marijuana came across the East San Gabriel Valley like a firestorm in 1967. Moving east from Hollywood through Pasadena, almost in a predictable railroad train-like manner. And several of us, almost all of my friends immediately got heavily involved in marijuana. And this wasn't experimenting, and it wasn't because we were trying to self-medicate or anything. It was just so darn much fun. And anybody who questions, why would young people smoke pot? Listen to what they tell us. And what they tell us is it's because it's incredibly pleasurable, which forces us to confront the question, are there things that are pleasurable that are not good for us or good for us collectively or good for us in the long run? And the pleasure principle, which was one of the guiding lights of the New Age, was that if it feels good, it is good.
Yeah, so what about these things you really want for yourself later in life? Right now, this is fun.
Yeah, and if you're being urged to live in the moment, which was the message we were getting from several sources back in those years, in the moment meant having as much fun as you possibly could.
Well, something that struck me, you say in your book, looking back, it seems that at least 80% of the guys I hung around with quickly switched from being just underage recreational alcohol users to regular cannabis users as well. So you said it seems like 80% of the guys you hung out with just switched from alcohol and didn't leave behind the alcohol. They just added
cannabis. No, you add
cannabis.
To it. You add to it. And I think one of the things to understand, though, is there were other groups of young people that weren't in my circle of friends. But by that time, I had already surrounded myself with things that we had in common. We were risk takers already. We'd get in the car and go to Tijuana at 1 in the morning for whatever reason. You know, we would be drag racing on the industrial back streets of North Azusa. You know, so we were already primed to say, you know, sitting at home and watching TV with the family. And we were pretty loosely supervised. That was a common thing, too. Most kids don't have the ability to just take off on a Tuesday night at 8 o'clock and go do something dangerous. So we were already, that was our group. And so when marijuana was presented to us, it was like, oh, boom, 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 boom. Everyone's into it.
You said, and this, you mentioned what a short time this took. By mid-fall, most of us were spending a good part of our time looking for pot, talking about it, smoking it, being stoned, and or looking for good places to get high. And so you said this wasn't experimenting with drugs. That phase lasted just a few days in most cases. Possibly the term applied to the guys and gals who might take a toke or two to be sociable at a gathering. But our group was, within just a handful of weeks, the dudes and a few young women who bought the dope gathered in a back room to look at it, feel it, smell it, and roll it up. Pot quickly moved to the center of our lives. So this was between 1968 and 72, there are probably just a few dozen days that did not include, for me at least, a couple of hours getting high, and most of my associates were into the same routine.
Oh, yeah. And I think if there are a lot of people my age walking around this town right now, if they were honest with you, they'd probably say, yeah, that sounds a lot like the way it was with me, too. But again, you know, you don't necessarily want to reveal the extent of all the stuff you did as a young person, but the idea that marijuana is harmless. I don't know where that came from, but it definitely has ramifications. Now, whether that's an argument for keeping it illegal, I don't know. But I do think that it is absolutely unwise to have folks as young as 15, 16, 17 having access to cannabis, knowing what we know now about brain development, and that the longer you put off your first exposure to drugs, the less likely it is that you will be addicted. And fortunately, I was 19 when I was first introduced to it, but some of the other folks in our group were as young as 13 and getting introduced to it at the same time.
Well, meanwhile, all this I'm just discovering, learning about now, because I was school and studies took center stage in my life, both in high school and in college. So all this is just a world that I've heard about, but I like hearing a firsthand account of what this was really like, Carl. So thank you for writing this. And you say in your book, from what I've seen, pot does not destroy lives quickly in the way that amphetamines or heroin often does, thus leading to many naive folks to conclude that it is harmless. Rather, it seemed to bend our lives in directions we could only see clearly from a vantage point decades later. And that's what you're saying, that at the time you really didn't see.
Well, you can't, because you don't have much perspective or experience when you're 19 or 20 years old. But in our family, it was, if you go back a couple generations, we had some famous doctors that were in our family. There was a good model of something that one could become. But in my case, I missed that boat. Because, you know, to work toward medical school, coming from a working class neighborhood, you need to be right on the ball from about 16 on forward. And that's
you can't
not
be
where...
skipping math and chemistry
art. No, you can't. So I'm grateful that I'm not plagued with regret, and I'm grateful that I was able to eventually acquire a graduate degree and get involved in rehabilitation administration and so forth. But there were a lot of opportunities that every child throws away when they make the choice to start living in the moment and seeking pleasure in any place they can find it.
And as I mentioned, in the back of your book, you give updates of what happened to these people, the characters in your story. For example, Jerry Nelson, you have a paragraph about him in the back of your book and the fact that he died at age 47. And then you add something that I've thought about, too. I've often wondered whether the need for the United States to import so many engineers and technical specialists from other countries may have something to do with how much intellectual talent we've allowed to be deflected by addictive substances of one kind or another.
Yes, and I just recently, I do an enormous amount of reading now. I just recently finished a book by Charles Murray, and he advocates in that book that we need to make sure that we maximize and make best use of our gifted kids and our gifted citizens. So somebody who has the intellectual horsepower and the talent to become an electronics engineer or become a neurosurgeon, he would suggest has an obligation to the rest of us to make the most of that.
Well, you have a list of characteristics of these people who indulge in marijuana, as you described, and there are about five characteristics you say that these, and you included, these characteristics you shared, and you said that what seemed to separate our crowd from those who were exposed to pot but did not follow through into addiction were the following. And you said you demonstrate an appetite for excitement. We were the kids who, even prior to exposure to drugs, were taking off to the beach at midnight and heading for Tijuana on a whim. So there were characteristics that you shared. And, for example, on your report card, what kind of notes would be on your report card?
Well, frequently my friends and I would have things that would suggest that the performance or achievement isn't up to apparent ability. And the problem is, or maybe the advantage is, I know so much now about brain science and so forth. We know now that impulse control is something that is varies from person to person. It's an issue in all young men. some more than others. And we now know that the frontal cortex doesn't mature until sometimes age 26 or 27. And that's the part that has to do with controlling those whims and those impulses and performing the executive functions that the brain needs to do. So, yeah, we were a group of people that would talk about something for 2 minutes and then do it.
You also say that none of us were or had been serious about any sort of organized religion, and none of us had parents who were active in a church.
Right, and I'm just putting that out there. Someone else needs to pursue it. I continue to be a, for all intents and purposes, a free thinker and an agnostic, but I have noticed that there is social value, and I didn't realize this, there's tremendous social value in institutions like churches in mitigating some of the less flattering aspects of human nature. And it seems like we just all have ignored that for several decades.
You say also that you were, with one exception, poorly or very loosely supervised beyond age 14 or 15, and you refer to this parenting approach as benign neglect. You say, as I entered my later teens, my closely monitored friends envied my ability to come and go as I pleased any day or night of the week.
Yes, and I think that's something that, and one of the reasons in the back of the book, I've put some discussion questions because I thought, well, maybe a parenting group might enjoy looking through this book and talking about, okay, parenting styles. How much supervision do teenage boys need? They don't need as much as 10-year-olds do. But they need some, and I think that in other societies and other ages, there were mechanisms where young men would be guided, supervised, redirected, sometimes maybe a little forcefully. But in Southern California in the 60s, 70s, and probably still today, you're pretty much freewheeling by the time you're 15, 16 years old, and nobody's going to yank your chain unless you do something that's against the law.
You do mention one of the characteristics that you shared. Almost all of us had experienced prior exposure to and use of alcohol and tobacco, with a high percentage of parents who recreated with these things. And you did mention that.
And, of course, a high percentage of adults smoked in those days.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, having mom and dad come home from the grocery store with a carton of Camels, that was real typical.
All you got to do is watch some old movies,
yeah.
And they're lighting up
yeah.
in every scene.
And so, and I think one of the things we need to realize is that alcohol, in its various forms, is a mind-altering subject. It's very or substance, and it's very widely used. And tobacco is highly addictive. We don't wonder why or say that people are self-medicating when they're addicted to cigarettes. Or when they drink beer, you know, 3 or 4 times a week. But we seem to gravitate toward that analysis for other drugs, especially in young people, and probably because it's more flattering to say my child is ill and is desperately trying to treat themselves than it is to say my child is hopelessly irresponsible, can't control her impulses, and is pleasuring herself as often as possible.
My guest is Carl Ochsner, and he has written a memoir, A New Age Diary, Personal Glimpses of Life in Postmodern America. And in your chapter on marijuana use, you conclude with an author's note. And here's where you say, based on your 35 years of your experiences, my focus has shifted from promoting the use of marijuana to joining forces with those who would prefer to see it pushed back into the margins of society. So this is a question that we have to face now. To what extent do we limit use of marijuana or not? And so what advice then do you have based on your experiences?
I don't know that I have any specific advice. I feel that we probably we can keep substances like alcohol and marijuana legal, but we don't need to make them available at every street corner. And I think one of the reasons our great-grandparents decided it's better just to prohibit these things is they probably couldn't figure out how do you allow access to adults and keep them away from kids. So those questions need to be wrestled with, And maybe that's the subject for another book and another discussion.
Well, another question that we wrestle with more and more towns, unfortunately, not just in California, the issue of homelessness. And that's another thing that intrigued me because I have no insight, I have no experience with that. And you do. You went up to San Francisco with a friend and you spent time homeless.
Oh, yeah. And I don't know the answer for every sort of person. Obviously, housing costs are very high. We don't have the kind of sleazebag hotels available that we did when I was 19. So that's an issue. But I'm also intrigued by the fact that the vast majority of people I see standing on street corners with cardboard signs or sitting in the park are working-age white males, supposedly America's most privileged group. And that is very intriguing to me. And that's one of the reasons I wrote this, is I said, you know what, I know why I ended up homeless, actually three times. I only mentioned two of them there. But it was very predictable, gravitating toward things that were fun, things that were less tedious, places that were fun to be. San Francisco in the late 60s was an exciting place. Beach was an exciting place. And then finding oneself a few weeks later completely out of resources and having to go to the, there used to be a group called the Diggers that offered medical services, and the Hare Krishnas had these big barrels full of rice with honey, and you could get a bowl full of that just for the asking. And the same sort of thing was going on then that seems to be going on now in a more aggravated way.
So I want to thank you for writing this memoir, Carl.
Well, thank you very much for having me. And I think anyone that's interested in the what is the nature of human nature question will find something of value in it.
Thank you. My guest has been Carl Ochsner. His book is Memoir, A New Age Diary, Personal Glimpses of Life in Postmodern America.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.